Hello, I'm Arvin Hickman, and welcome to the PR Weekly, your weekly fix of PR industry news, analysis, and gossip. I'm joined by my colleague, John Harrington, editor of PR Week UK. How's it going, John?
Good, thank you, Arvin. Really good. It's been a busy week, but a good one.
It has, and we had a bit of a break last week, didn't we? Because it was a short week, and we couldn't quite get things together. What's happened in the past week for you?
A lot. We are coming towards the end of a lot of our projects. The Top 150 coverage has finally ended, so thank you everyone for reading that and taking part in that. We have 30 Under 30 coming up, the profiles. We announced who was in it quite recently, so that's exciting. We've had our Best Places to Work announcement. That was last week, so congratulations everyone there. It's been a hectic time, and we got PR 360 coming up week after next. So yeah, it's been no end of things happening, and I'm taking a week off the week after next.
A well-deserved week. I mean, April and May is absolutely crazy at PR Week. There's just so many things coming out all the time.
Yeah, it is. But there's been a lot of news as well. So it's not just been our own projects, you know. We're going to come on to some of this stuff later, but, you know, there's been some big appointments, big news in mergers and acquisitions. And there's been company results and all sorts of stuff, as well as the usual kind of reputation issues that organisations have been having, and quite a lot of politics too.
Absolutely, absolutely. And later on in this programme, we're going to have Sonia Khan from Cicero AMO and Emily Wallace from Inflect Partners talking about all of the local election results and the comms around it and what it means for the future. Something to look forward to. John, the first thing we want to discuss today is M&As. Now, I read an article last year about how the mergers and acquisitions market should have been pretty hot, because you're going to have a lot of PR agencies who are struggling, those who you know weren't necessarily well run, or those who were exposed to sectors that were going through a really hard time. That happened to a very small degree, but it didn't quite happen to the degree that a lot of people expected it to. What has been sort of your take on what's happened since? I know you've written this really in-depth piece and you spoke to many people about it. Why hasn't M&As gone through the roof, and where is it going now?
Well, no, you're right. I mean, there's I did write this article where I talk about this kind of flurry of recent activity. I mean, just this week we had Clarity acquiring a creative SEO paid and analytics agency called Three White Hats, and Headland, you know, the fast-growing corporate and public affairs consultancy, getting minority investment from LDC, which is Lloyds Bank's private equity arm. And there have been more in recent weeks. I mean, my take on it is we're basically seeing a return to something like familiarity with M&A, albeit as with a lot of things around this COVID era, at an accelerated rate. I mean, I think the really important point here is we're not seeing fire sales. We're not seeing the sort of quick sales by agencies that are desperate to salvage something from their businesses. This really didn't materialize, as you say, in any great extent last year. It may have been that it was furlough helped stave off some things, but you know, there was a clear recovery generally in the PR industry towards the middle part, and certainly the back end of 2020, and that's continued into 2021.
Do you think that this is actually quite a positive story? I mean, if we're thinking about what was predicted, it was fire sales. We got a few agencies collapse that we reported on, but actually nowhere near the volume that maybe ourselves, but also maybe some industry leaders and insiders would have predicted. Do you think in a way that it's kind of a positive story for the business model of a PR and comms agency?
I do think it is that. I mean, what we found, we've reported multiple times that effectively for a lot of agencies, the taps were turned off in Q2. I mean, that really was a disastrous quarter. But for a lot of the services that PR agencies were providing were in great demand over that period, particularly corporate crisis, public affairs, and also things like healthcare. And you could also include in that things like tech, with the sort of switch to kind of people working from home and technology-based entertainment and commerce and so on being so much more important. And then we were seeing a return to a bit of positivity as the economy opened up in the summer. And of course, there were difficulties towards the end of last year. But towards the start of this year, there was a sense that clients were getting their act together, getting their plans together, getting their budgets sorted. And we were seeing a return to growth for a lot of agencies. I think one of the things about a lot of the agencies that have been sold recently is that those agencies have been performing well. You know, if you look at someone like, you mentioned Publicis. I mean, Publicis' most recent acquisition was Taylor Herring. Mm. Taylor Herring grew 13% last year. And that's an agency that's had, you know, a great reputation for its consumer PR campaigns for several years. They also bought Octopus, which is very high performing B2B agency that topped the top 150 B2B table for the last 2 years. So, and then if you look at Headland as well, as I mentioned, they had an investment from LDC. They grew 20% last year. So this is, and in the case of Headland, you know, LDC took a minority investment in that. The management maintains its controlling stake. So these are not fire sales. I think what's happening is buyers are seeing this as an opportunity to add to their assets. The background here is the huge amount of optimism in the UK PR industry at the moment. As our top 150 research found that almost all agencies that answered the question said they were either moderately or very confident about the strength of trading in 2021. We're seeing that big holding groups and well-funded private agencies are eyeing opportunities to bring in skills and brands to make themselves more attractive for clients and make the most of these opportunities. An important, and this is why I go back to that point about we're seeing a familiar trend, because this was happening before the pandemic. I think there's been a bit of a myth that listed holding companies, the big Marcoms groups, have given up on M&A around PR in recent years, that it was all about private equity. And I think that there's an element of truth in this, in that private equity has made the biggest acquisitions. You think of Teneo, Huntsworth and Instinctive. They've all had new private equity backers in the last couple of years. But we've also seen that holding companies would invest if it meant improving their existing offer. So Havas buying Cicero, the public affairs specialist, and Weber Shandwick buying digital agencies, That Lot and Flipside. So this all happened before the pandemic. So we're seeing kind of a return to this trend.
I think it's a really interesting point. And one thing I would add to that, if private equity is eyeing out this part of Marcoms, there's a reason for it. It's because they think it's profitable. They think they can turn it around, make a margin, and move on. So in a way, it kind of underlines why internally some of these big holding groups would be eyeing these things out. Because let's be honest, PR and comms agencies have done much better than other parts of their groups.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I mean, there was a huge disparity in performance of PR agencies in that we found in the top 150 research. And as I've spoken about before, it's quite difficult actually to say what normal was last year. So we've seen a lot of individual agencies perform pretty well. And even those that didn't perform that well, a lot of them performed a lot better towards the back end of last year and are performing better this year. So I almost think the performance last year needs to be seen in the context that it was a blip, you know, and it was a very obvious blip caused by a very obvious horrendous thing. But you're exactly right. I mean, private equity's interest has not diminished. We saw this huge amount of interest before the pandemic, and we're seeing it now. So we've got Headland, also Finn Partners, which made an acquisition in April. That's backed by Stagwell, a private equity firm. And indeed, Blue Focus International, which includes We Are Social and Citizen Relations. It's had a new majority investment owner in the form of two private equity groups, CVC Capital and CDPQ. So, as I say, it's familiar. Private equity is interested in this space. It has been for a long time. It's still interested in this space, particularly if you've got assets that have been shown to be performing strongly. So we should all be encouraged by this. People are interested in this sector because it's a sector to be interested in. They're not interested in it for asset stripping. They're interested in it for asset growing and asset enhancing. So I do think that this is the industry should be very positive about all of this. And I, as a journalist, I'm always looking for, like, you know, what's the downside? And of course there will be downsides. I mean, not all of these things are going to work. And a lot of agencies are still finding things difficult, but I certainly think that these trends recently, as one person mentioned to me, we've gone from a situation where it was about the M of the M&A, and it's gone to the A of the M&A. So you think last year, WPP's Finsbury, Glover, Herring, and the most obvious example, you know, of a merger of some really big global giants. And you're seeing other examples of that. This year, it's been about acquisitions. It's been about agencies buying in specialisms to make them better, make them more effective in terms of what clients need. And it's been about private equity looking at where the opportunities are to get a good return on investment. So yeah, I think we should look at this in a in an upbeat way. And it was good to talk to. I should probably mention Joe Hine of SI Partners and Andrew Block of a PCB Partners and formerly of Frank, who I spoke to or we spoke to about this recently for this analysis. But yeah, I think things are familiar in a good way.
What is their take in terms of optimism, in terms of how busy they are?
Well, I mean, they say that it's almost unprecedented levels of activity at the moment because there's a real sense that private equity are of the view that communications is a good add-on and it's a good investment. And there's a sense that management companies as well are looking at strategic communications companies and that the offers, the opportunities are there across a variety of different sectors, you know, B2B is seen as one that's been highlighted, and Octopus is one of the biggest B2B agencies. And there've been other B2B acquisitions. Hotwire acquisition recently was a B2B agency. You know, there's a lot of activity, and as I say, it's coming from a position of strength, I think, from the agencies.
It all sounds very positive. Let's talk about something else. I mean, earlier this week, I had a bit of research presented to me from Perspectus. Thank you very much, Ellie Glasson. Basically, they polled 120 journalists about what their experience was of PR during the pandemic. It's something that people like you and me are very familiar with and can really relate to. Some of the key findings was that, you know, at least half are only looking for relevant content. Don't bother contacting me if you don't know me. If I don't respond to you, it's because I'm too busy. I don't want to cover your story. Those sorts of sentiments. But, and this is the big but, which probably got left off some of the tweets that happened afterwards. When PR is really good, it's really good. It's really valuable. And stretched journalists really value it. Now, the background and context of this is that, you know, and you know, let's be honest here. Newsrooms have shrunk over the pandemic. Media companies have gotten smaller. Even in PR Week, we lost a reporter. He was made redundant. Thankfully, he's moved to Third Sector, which is a sister publication. But the point is, journalists have less time to deal with PR. And I thought this was a really interesting bit of research in terms of getting the sentiment. It doesn't sound like it's really exposing things that previously, you know, we didn't know, but the urgency feels a bit higher. What was your take on it, John?
You know, I'll stand up for the PR industry at every turn, and I certainly think that I don't really understand why journalists would say they won't take calls or pictures from someone they don't know. I mean, that makes no sense to me, and I know that journalists can be grumpy and difficult to deal with a lot of the time. I, you know, dare say I can fall into that category on occasion if I've not had enough caffeine or hadn't slept well enough. But, you know, I do think that I do urge PR professionals to read this and take the message of this report seriously. I mean, I've seen some comments online saying things like, it only takes a second to say no thanks. I don't think the PRs who say this have ever worked as a journalist.
When people say, you know, it takes half a second to say no thank you, that half a second times how many emails we get every day of the week ends up completely occupying your mind, and you can't work as a journalist if you do that.
You can't. And there is also the point that it's often it's not just a simple thanks but no thanks. Often what happens is they will say, oh, could you tell me why? Could you give me some feedback? Should I go to someone else? Should I do this with it? So then, you know, if you times that by 50 or 100 every day, I'll give you a bit of an idea, you know, from my point of view. And I'm not saying this to be kind of woe is me, is my life difficult? You know, I like my job and I like the fact I'm busy, I'm involved in lots of things. But, you know, at certain points of the last couple of months, I've worked on 20 different projects at one time. And this doesn't include admin issues like, you know, HR, if IT goes wrong, employee issues, you know, multiple internal meetings about various things, chasing photos. You know, this takes a huge amount of time and it is mentally draining. And the idea that if you might spend, let's say, 10, 11, 12 hours a day on all of this and you're following up all of those emails around these things, at that point, you would look through those 50 to 100 press releases or other unrelated emails you get, cold pitches. The idea that you would then respond to all of those at that point, it's not realistic. And I would really like it if I had enough time to do that, but I don't. And I'm not saying this to be the sort of, you know, arrogant, aren't I important journalist. I'm just saying this is the way it is. We don't have the resources that we used to have. We're involved in so many more things. Being a journalist now is not really what it was, certainly 5 years ago, 10 years ago. We are involved in so many different aspects of media.
It's a really good point, John. And I want to, I'm going to invest a bit of my own previous history here. When I started out in journalism in the very late 90s, early 2000s, you know, you got you basically got informed by two things. One was a fax machine, the other was a telephone. Email was pretty much very basic back in those days, and people didn't use it to inform journalists. So you go into your newsroom, you have discussion, there'd be like fax papers on the table, and then you'd be like, you know, stationed out. You got to go and see this press call or whatever. You've got to go and investigate this. In this day and age, with email, you know, we're getting bombarded by so many things. And, you know, I would probably estimate, I don't know what your estimate is, I'd estimate that maybe, you know, 90 to 95% of them are not things that we would write about. And if you actually went to the website and read what we do, you might appreciate the things that we do write about. But I understand that, you know, a lot of PR professionals don't have the time to do that, and it's not fair to expect them to do that. I just think that there is so much waste of effort on you know, both the PR side and the journalist side, because there is so many time pressures on both sides to get things out, do things, chase things. I think there has to be a better way of doing this.
I mean, I think we need to look at why this is. I mean, there could be a number of reasons. Firstly, you know, it may well be that the client is adamant that this needs to be done. And even if the PR knows exactly what you're describing and knew it in the past, sometimes that can cause a difficult situation where the PR is doing stuff they know isn't going to work, but they just have to do it to tick it off a list. And I think that's probably comes back to sort of poor client agency relations, and something that should be looked at.
But I think this is where the industry needs to be stronger and say, you know what, they're not going to buy it, so you're wasting your time.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have thought so. It should be at the stage where PRs are there for their strategic advice as much as their ability to do things like send press releases, and they should
absolutely
part of the benefit of having PRs is to know what not to do as well as what to do and how to do that. I mean, I also think that there is a real need to emphasize the basics. Sometimes I think, you know, there are some brilliant PRs in this industry. There are some incredibly smart people who know exactly what they're doing. But I also think sometimes there's a danger in any industry of looking at the sort of shiny new thing and ignoring the basics that make the industry tick. And I think one of those things is writing good press releases. And I mean really good press releases that get to the point quickly and are very well targeted. And I am concerned sometimes that this basic skill is being prioritized less than things like digital skills, content creation. All of these things are important, but I think these basic skills are incredibly important. I remember that in the top 150 analysis, media relations went ahead of content creation, I think, as the top priority for agencies to invest this year, which I think is really important. And I think that's really good to see, because I don't think that it can ever be underestimated how important this sort of thing is. You know, of course you can get unlucky. You could have a great well-targeted press release that doesn't work because the journalist is too busy or they didn't see it or for whatever reason. And I'm not saying there shouldn't ever be follow-ups, but I do think that these sort of basic skills need to be emphasized over and over again. And I do think that there does need to be understanding from the PR's point of view about the pressure journalists are under, as much as there needs to be understanding from journalists about the situation that PR professionals are in.
We work in a relationship. It sometimes is awkward, but we both need to work together to make it make the best of it. And the best PR journalist relationships are the ones where we know the PR person. They know us. They know what we want. They know how we react to things. They know the time to call us or the time to email us, and vice versa. What's happened over the years since I started as a journalist is we have become much more reliant on PR professionals. Absolutely. You know, we rely on you guys for great stories, for contacts and clients. We have to work better as a team.
I think some journalists will just have a kind of knee-jerk reaction to PRs that, you know, they don't know what they're doing and they're fluffy and all of these kind of terrible stereotypes that are almost always completely incorrect. I do urge everyone to take that on board and take surveys like this seriously. I don't assume it's just journalists sort of whinging, because we are under a lot of pressure these days, and it is important to recognise that.
We are joined by Inflec Partners founder and CEO Emily Wallace and Cicero AMO Associate Director Sonia Khan. Emily is a former chair of Clapham Town Labour, while Sonia was previously a special advisor to two Conservative chancellors, and she also served as campaign manager for Number 10 under Prime Minister David Cameron. Thank you both for joining us.
Nice to be here.
There are some clear trends in the recent elections that happened over the weekend, and one of those being that Conservatives still do well in Leave voting areas, which indicates Brexit divisions are still very much in play. But, you know, on the flip side, Labour has done well in some of the major mayor races. You know, we're talking about Liverpool, Manchester and London, to name a few. However, many are still questioning what Keir Starmer stands for and his vision. And, you know, when these elections happened, there was a backdrop of a successful rollout of the COVID vaccine. So I guess my first question for both of you was, what do you make of the election results, given the current situation? Sonia, I'm going to ask you first, and then Emily.
I thought the results were really interesting for anyone who is very interested in politics, not least because everyone expected a big bounce for the party in government with the vaccine rollout, but probably not to the extent that we had it. And results like Hartlepool were definitely downplayed by the Conservatives. So they felt very touch and go, even if they weren't in the end. And people like Andy Street, who win the West Midlands, those seats are always very unpredictable in that they don't have a loyalty to anyone really. And so to see places like Sandwell, which is, you know, where I'm from and is the home of Enoch Powell's Rivers of Blood Scooch. So, you know, an area that never ever votes Conservative, to have, you know, six councillors was just outstanding. I think that it does set the next election up to be a great fall for the party in government. But I actually think that it's quite exciting for Labour, who now have the chance to really revitalise their policies, to come back with something quite sort of revolutionary.
That's really interesting you say that, because a lot of people are sort of observing this as some sort of major fail for Keir Starmer and his 1 year in power. But you seem to strike a more optimistic note.
Well, I just think it's a very, very difficult set of local elections because of the times that we're in. And they don't take into account things like fatigue with the party in government. We haven't really gotten to look at lots of domestic issues in a great deal of detail because COVID has dominated things like social care, funding for people with disabilities or special needs, things that can often make or break a local election during normal times. So I think these have set a very, very high bar for the governing party, but probably the next set of local elections might be a fairer reflection of kind of where people are when we see some of the COVID bounce come off.
Okay. Emily, what's your take?
Well, I wish more people inside the Labour Party were as enthusiastic and optimistic as Sonia, because that isn't quite how it's felt over the last week. With lots of Labour colleagues sort of tried to digest the results. And I think the things that have struck me most are the fact that And for policy watchers, it's really interesting in the sense that, is this really a realignment of British politics? You know, the fact that Labour is doing well in kind of metropolitan liberal areas, not just within London, but, you know, outside of London, in the West Country, in Bristol, in Bath, you know, does Labour need to think differently about where its vote lies in the future? And so those are the sorts of conversations that we've been having over the last week. I think there's another really interesting kind of a comment around incumbency. You know, the fact that all parties, the SNP, Labour and the Tories, did really well in areas where they are in control, in Manchester, in Scotland, in London and in Wales. I think that shows that strong leadership and visible leadership really does translate into votes. So there are some interesting lessons to be learnt, and I'm in the optimistic camp, Sonia, with you, but that isn't necessarily reflected in all of the conversations that I'm having with my Labour colleagues at the moment.
Yeah, and we will come to that in a bit. I want to just talk a little bit about the campaigns leading into this. Obviously, you know, it's unprecedented times. It's very difficult to run a campaign when you're, you know, the whole country's in lockdown. I know there was lots of, you know, door knocking and efforts towards the end. Sonia, I'm going to ask you to have a go at the Conservative campaign, and Emily, I want you to have a crack at the Labour campaign and just give your honest take about how effective those were. And why or why not? Sonia, let's start off with you.
Yeah, so I think the Conservative campaign always does well because it's able to corral people to go out and campaign and door knock. And when you have such a significant sort of bounce from the vaccination going so well, it's probably much easier to bring people together and to get them out than it is, say, if you're in opposition or you have been in opposition for a while. So I think that definitely helps. And we saw it in the previous years with battle buses. I mean, there were always issues around sort of funding and whatever else. But, you know, I grew up in the Conservative Party, so I've grown up doing a lot of these things. And, you know, I saw people who were first-time voters, people who were, you know, had voted for many, many years coming out. So I think the Conservative campaign is quite good at bringing together kind of all of those people who perhaps often feel slightly ostracised in their local communities, because it's not always a cool thing to admit that you're a Conservative, or it's definitely not the thing that's going to make you very popular where you are. So I think that helps. I think the fact that they use cabinet ministers sparingly also helps. It gave a lot of the local candidates a chance. And I also think a lot of especially the 2019 intake of MPs, their PR and comms is great. You know, lots of them have local slogans. They don't always use the national kind of infographics or the national slogans. I see them for the Black Country that say things like "for the Black Country from." So people have really built up, especially with MPs, a sense that, you know, they are the local advocates. They are the people who represent their constituents. You know, they're not the Westminster types. And I feel that has come across quite keenly, especially in lots of the, I guess they're not new red wall seats now. So I think there are two factors for me that make kind of the Conservative Party's campaign a success: just their resource and their people, but also the stars are the new 2019ers, who know how to use social media, who know how to use media, who present themselves as great local people.
You made two really interesting points there, Sonia. The first one was how much you believe that local MPs are the stars of a show. I mean, a lot of the media is focusing on Boris and how he's made of Teflon and how he can pretty much do anything and get away with it. But people like him. So you reckon actually it's not really about that. It's more about local MPs connecting with people. The second point that you made, which was really interesting, are the tactics and the channels and the use of social media. I mean, the Conservatives definitely, if you look at the amount of money they spent in the last election, exceeded Labour, but also you might argue they were more clever about those tactics as well. What's your view on both of those points?
I think it's a very good one, and the general election was a great example where we saw eye-catching infographics that weren't perhaps the most aesthetically pleasing, but they got you talking.
I'm going to ask you this question: were they ethical?
What do you mean, as in, were they ethical?
I mean, some of them were sort of like misinterpreting things like for example, they're presenting to be websites they weren't or organizations they weren't.
I don't think you can apply that to local elections, because the thing most people care about is kind of local data, local interest. And I don't think we have that problem as much. But I think you can just reach kind of so many people locally in wards that might be difficult, wards that might not answer, you know, your door when you ring and you try to canvass their vote. Quite an effective and probably cheaper way. And I think actually we saw in this campaign, Boris wasn't out as much as he has been in previous ones. And I think that's just a reflection of the fact that people don't always want to hear from national politicians. They want to hear from people who understand their issues, their problems. They know about the local mm-hmm. roads. You know, so seeing these people once or twice doing a stunt, riding, you know, riding a bike, going to visit John Lewis or whatever else, that's not the stuff that lands in the minds of most kind of everyday voters.
It's local action, right? In terms of, I'm really interested in terms of your tactics in the previous election. What sort of channel was the best for you? Was it Facebook? Where did you find the most traction in terms of getting your message out there for local MPs trying to get elected?
You know, it's so many because there are different audiences, but probably where the most gains have been made is the fact that lots of people are now on Snapchat. We always say Twitter is the preserve of the Westminster elite. So it's where, you know, a lot of people in politics go. But yeah, you know, Snapchat, Facebook, Instagram, things that are much more visual, short, snappy videos that tell you what you need to know. You know, it's small things like making sure the subtitling works so people can watch things on the go. I think that's where we've seen like a real set of expansion. Probably the best person who gets this right is Rishi Sunak. You know, he's really cultivated a brand by bringing kind of one theme to the forefront.
That's a really, really interesting insight. Emily, I'm going to ask you, to assess Labour's campaign as well. It sounds like the Conservative Party, I mean, even if you observe it as a journalist, has been a bit more sophisticated when it comes to using digital channels. How would you assess Labour's campaign and their tactics?
Well, I don't think it really felt like one campaign. And, you know, I mean, I guess it doesn't always feel like that with local elections. And these were predominantly local elections. So local councillors being elected up and down the country, along with MSPs and Welsh Assembly members and London Assembly members. So I don't think that Labour's national campaign was actually particularly helpful, because we were focusing really at national level on the kind of Tory sleaze. And I'm not sure that translated much into people voting Labour at local level. Where we've done well is where we've got good, strong leaders running their own campaigns around their own record. And that then has translated into votes. So, you know, Hartlepool for us was a kind of really poor result, but it was the only parliamentary election. We had a really short run into it, and we weren't, I don't think, supported by a strong a national campaign. I think if there'd been a general election, then we would have seen a kind of different result. I'm in London, and the London campaign, I mean, it got off, you know, it had been delayed a year. So, you know, already started campaigning kind of a year and a half ago for these elections. And there was a really strong, clear message and lots of material coming out. I think we probably are behind on the digital campaign. And what's interesting is, though, we're well, well ahead in terms of younger voters. So we ought to, thank you for the tip, Sonia. We ought to be really thinking about how do we really build that digital campaign and to increase certainly the people that we get, the younger people and the vote and their votes for Labour. I don't think our national campaign really helped, and I'm not sure it felt like a campaign. It definitely felt like lots of different campaigns happening around the country, and where Labour were strong and had good, you know, good infrastructure, then they maintained that and did well. And where they didn't, then it was a much more mixed picture.
It's an interesting point, the fact that you don't feel there was a very strong overriding national campaign. In Hartlepool, though, I mean, you had your MP who resigned for very questionable reasons. I mean, do you think that had a bit of an impact, or do you think it was more just, you know, that part of England had enough and they wanted change?
One of the things I've learned is I'm a Londoner based in London. And yes, I'm a public affairs consultant and follow everything really closely, but I'm absolutely not an expert on what the people of Hartlepool think and wouldn't ever pretend to be. And I think one of the lessons for us as a party is that we really need to listen to those people and ask them that question, you know, what is it? You know, we haven't done that very effectively as a party. We've spent more time worrying about what other members of the Labour Party think about the Labour Party leader than we have worried about what the voters of Hartlepool think about the Labour Party leader. And I'd really be interested to have that conversation with those people that voted Tory and think about, you know, what were those reasons. I'm sure the local MP was that, you know, there was one reason, but I'm sure there were lots and lots and lots of others as well. I think that's what we really need to begin to understand. It's certainly been a wake-up call for the Labour Party, and there's a lot of thinking that needs to be done off the back of it.
The reason why I ask you that, Emily, because one of the things I found really remarkable during the elections is some of the responses from people in Hartlepool. There's a clip on Twitter that really expresses this. Have a listen to this.
I suppose it's like for Hartlepool and the likes of a Labour, it stems back to your granddad, your dad, and it's passed on to you. You vote Labour because we're working class, etc., etc. And now we're getting to a stage where you can sort of think for yourself, we've had enough of Labour. They've just wrecked it, everything.
Wrecked it,
totally. The hospital. We haven't even got a cell where we can lock someone up on a night. We haven't got a court where we can take them to court. Yeah. What's that all about?
We're big time. Yeah.
These aren't Labour problems. These are Conservative problems. Why is it that they're pinning this on Labour?
I mean, it's shocking, isn't it, that after 11 years of Conservative and coalition government, that the people of Hartlepool are blaming the fact that their hospital has been moved and that they don't have cells in their town, blaming those on Labour because they've always voted Labour. What I would say is that I think that is a failure of communication, that for whatever reason, those people don't associate the kind of austerity programme of 2010 onwards with a Conservative government. They associate that with the fact that they've always voted Labour, and so there's a huge communications challenge to overcome there.
I want to ask Sonia about this as well. Is there something, some masterstroke that the Johnson government has done, or maybe it was Dominic Cummings, or someone who's basically flipped this whole idea of austerity and made people think, actually, it's our local MPs who are responsible, not the government? What do you think is at play here, Sonia?
It's a good question. I think part of the reason that narrative has probably turned on its head is that Boris Johnson is much better at sort of promoting good news and probably not focusing as much on bad news. And I found that many people who I know who campaigned and canvassed felt that the Labour campaign was very national, so pushing messages mm-hmm. around sleaze and how contracts are appointed, which, you know, are hugely important. But, you know, as Emily said, clearly with the people who voted in Hartlepool, their concerns were very, very local and they weren't addressed. So I actually don't think it was about burying kind of the austerity message at all. It was just about what the sort of core narrative was that the parties were going to prioritise. And I thought it was really interesting that the government didn't trail the Queen's speech a lot more, because you can then point to sort of policies that you're going to promote that might help sort of bridge some of the issues with problems around funding for policing or whatever else. You could say, well, actually, we're going to have this policy. But I think instead they decided to focus it on kind of efforts during COVID. And clearly that has landed. And, you know, people were feeling much better about COVID. The fact that, you know, we're coming out of these lockdowns, the vaccine rollout is going well. They're seeing their friends and family a bit more. The weather's improving, which I think probably played a part, or is definitely something you worry about when you run a local campaign. So I actually think that was a very, very big factor. I heard time and time again that, you know, local Labour councillors were just landing messages that people weren't listening to or didn't care about when they voted.
It's a really good point, isn't it, about how, you know, the different tactics, you know, Labour focusing on some of these bigger picture national issues, whereas the Conservatives making sure that they're kind of looking after the local issues. I want to ask, well, we're talking about Labour in terms of comms, you know, if we're looking at the sort of wash of what's happened in the past week, it appears that Labour has been very busy infighting And the Conservatives haven't really had much to say beyond the referendum in Scotland. I mean, I'm going to ask you this first one now. I mean, what is your take on what's going on with Labour comms post election? And Emily, I'm sure you've got loads to talk about once Sonia finishes.
Yeah, I think it's a real shame that the focus has been on who's going to get promoted, who's not, who's been gossiping about whoever else, because you really want to take this time to dissect the results and focus your energy on understanding why people who voted for you no longer vote for you. And I think the data collection has gotten a lot, that's probably the wrong word, but, you know, looking at data more, utilising data more is something the Conservative Party has gotten a lot better about, you know, creating these profiles of the typical voter and learning how to create a campaign around them and make it targeted and not go for everyone is kind of, you know, often what they do after general elections in public affairs, we'd have a wash up after, you know, landing a big piece of comms, whereas Labour haven't had the chance to do that because it's so focused on infighting. And, you know, for me, there was a real distinction between kind of Jeremy Corbyn and Keir Starmer, and one was much more sort of grown up, professional. And that was sort of harmed by what happened after the local election, which was just, you know, a huge amount of briefing that you thought Keir Starmer had under control, or at least, you know, you have the sense that this was someone who could manage the party a bit more. But if that's it will feel like to a lot of people, the same issues are still there. So if Keir Starmer can't, you know, fix them or manage them, can any Labour leader? Are these issues just too big for one party leader? And actually, is there a structural problem in how Labour works and is set up?
Emily, what's your response? Because this seems like a really important issue, and it's a really important comms issue.
It does. I mean, it's sort of where to start. I love the fact that you said that Labour's been infighting for the last week, because I'm pretty sure it's been 5 years.
At least 5 years.
That's what it feels like anyway. I mean, I, as I said, I'm an optimist, and I kind of feel like this is our rock bottom moment. There are lots of issues around comms over the last week that I think have sort of all come together to have kind of got us to the point where we are now. This was a really difficult, it all started really when we went out with after the Hartlepool result. And the problem we had was that was the first result that was announced of the election results. And we then had results coming out over 3 days. And we got off on a really bad foot in the sense that we had to accept a really poor result first before all the good results came in. And then for some reason, Keir decided to do a reshuffle in the middle of that before the election results had all come through. And so I feel like there are a few kind of few issues and errors of judgment there. But where we find ourselves now, sort of a week later, is actually, I think, in a better place. So from the conversations that I've had locally within my local Labour Party, there's actually quite a bit of consensus around the fact that actually, if we want Labour Party to win, and we're all members of the Labour Party, although it doesn't always feel like that, if we want Labour to win, then actually we have to start looking at the electorate and not be worried about each other. And so I really do hope that the kind of rock bottom moment is now, and from here on we can begin to build back better, to coin a phrase. And I don't think that there's any question that will be with Keir Starmer as leader. So it's a kind of positive, optimistic view, really, over what has been a bit of a car crash week in terms of comms.
I mean, you say that very optimistically, and I'm sure that's what you hope. But let's be honest here, Emily, it's been going on for years. I mean, it's also happening with the Australian Labor Party. It just seems with Labor parties at the moment, there's so much factional infighting. There are so many own goals presented to the often conservative opposition parties who tend to be in power. How do you think this gets resolved? I mean, and why is it when Labour has fights, the dirty laundry is aired in public, but when the Conservative Party has fights, it's not?
I'm not sure I can answer that question. I mean, I think that we're by nature open and transparent as a party. Maybe that's it. I mean, I think there are some really interesting questions about the future of the Labour Party in the UK and whether or not we are seeing some sort of realignment. And whether or not we do look at Whether we are a party which can build a broad coalition which includes the voters of Hartlepool alongside the voters of Bristol, or whether we do have to look at, you know, where we can win as a party and start to think, mm-hmm. well, actually, you know, should we be targeting kind of former Lib Dem areas? Should we be targeting different parts of the country? I mean, I don't have the answers to that, but I do think that there is some really interesting discussion that can take place. I also think that we need to think very carefully, and this is a really strong message that's coming out about what is our offer to the country. And I think, you know, I do not believe that Keir has effectively articulated what the Labour offer to the country currently is, and that is the job that he must do next. And so, you know, who are we trying to talk to, and what are we trying to say to them? It's kind of a fairly basic kind of thing that you would do with any comms strategy. So go back to basics, talk to people about what they want from the Labour Party, and work out what your electoral strategy is. So I'm really pleased that they've now appointed Deborah Mattison to be the Director of Strategy at the party. I think that's a really fantastic appointment and should give some really good insight and help towards that process. But there's a long, long, long way to go.
Sonia, I just want to ask you a couple of questions. Firstly, why are Conservatives much better at not airing the dirty laundry? And secondly, what do you think the priority should be for Boris Johnson's government in terms of comms in the months ahead?
I mean, on the first one, I don't think that has always been true. When you look back at sort of previous governments and issues like Brexit, which have been divisive and people, you know, have been open about their personal positions. And then you had Johnny Mercer, who was quite unhappy with his ministerial position and was very open about why. But I think that it's especially with the team who are in place now, they want to be much more kind of grown up. They don't fan the flames. Actually, they take a lot of the hits, and you see that with the speculation in the Mail about Boris's personal finances or his relationship with Carrie. And, you know, they're hugely personal things and they must cut very, very deep. And he's clearly, and the team are clearly resisting the urge to hit back hard. But I think they know that ultimately it's not to their benefits. But perhaps that's where it's kind of a little bit different with Labour. I mean, I'm not a Labour expert by any means, but I think for Conservatives, they're probably driven by ruling and winning, and that's the ultimate goal, regardless of anything else. And so that's probably why some people take a step back. I think on priorities now, the big question is just how is the government going to rebuild the country post-COVID-19, and what does that vision look like? And I'm not sure I really know what that is in the Queen's speech. There are some, you know, really great set of policies within that. But there's no big overarching vision that says, right, our economy will look like this. We're going to be embracing new industries, more sustainable industries. But that means there will have to be some quite tough choices about, you know, what we lose. And I think the discussion about coal was a really fascinating one. And we haven't really answered tough questions like, what does the future of social care look like? It's quite interesting that there's clear division between number 10 and number 11 that existed when I was there, that is playing out again on the right way forward. So I think to me, it would be, you know, much more macro, talk to people and be transparent about what kind of country you want to lead, what kind of economy, probably have some of the discipline of the referendum campaigns where they focus on, say, just a few core issues rather than so many. There were, you know, 25, was it nearer 30 bills? It was a bit hard to identify what the lead priority was. And so most broadcasters led on the most contentious bits, which were around the union. So I think in terms of communications priorities, it would be, you know, to prioritise, to open up kind of transparency, to maintain efforts to reach kind of groups that the Conservatives haven't, and to try new things. So actually, you know, having a new approach to digital is really welcome. And I quite like the fact that a lot of the sort of 2019 intake worked really hard in explaining Parliament to people. I think that's a really nice touch, and probably one of the reasons why they managed to break down the perceptions of a Westminster-based MP. You know, they took them through, what is a Queen's speech? How does it work? What does an MP do? You know, how does PMQs work? I think those kinds of efforts are rewarded by their voters, and it's good that they have the freedom to do that from the top.
Emily, I'll get you on one final question. I know you kind of touched on this before, but what should the priorities be for Keir Starmer in terms of his comms strategy for the months ahead?
I think that Keir needs to really focus on how to present the party to the country and to... And of course we do, and I think that that will, if we start to get traction in terms of building a policy platform that will appeal to huge swathes of the country, that will unite the party around him. So the comms message, I think, has to be about a process and a vision for how we, the Labour Party, can become a really powerful electoral force for the country, and to set a vision for how we can be a party of government once again. And I think that if he gets that right, then the party will fall into line behind him. I don't really sense any real threat to his leadership, but I do think that he needs to quite quickly start to put in place and give people confidence that he is the man that will be able to lead us through this next stage of the journey. And if he fails to do that, then I think that it will be a really continue to be a bit of a turbulent time for the party.
Do you think the party needs a bit of a rebrand,
like in the 1990s? I'm not sure that's necessary. I do think we do need to, I don't think we need a new brand or anything, but I do think we need to decide what we stand for. The party of fairness and equality, but it has to be built on what resonates with people and what they, and it has to be based on the sort of where we want to, the voters that we want to win over and the places that we want to win. So it needs to be based on, it's a rebrand based on clear strategy and target and prioritisation. I mean, I'd really be interested in talking to the Labour people in, Labour members in Scotland as well, because I think it's really difficult for Labour to form a government in Westminster without the support of the voters in Scotland. So there needs to be a really big thinking exercise.
Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. Thank you, John, for joining us. Also, thank you, Sonia and Emily, and also our producer, Lindsay Riley from Rethink Audio. If you have enjoyed this podcast, please do visit prweek.com/UK to stay up to date with all of our news and analysis, and would also love to hear your feedback on the PR Weekly. We hope you have enjoyed this episode, and we look forward to you listening again. Until then, goodbye.